Well, grace to you and peace be multiplied through Jesus Christ our Lord. It's a delight to be with you. We've been looking forward to this time for a while now. And on the way here, one of our children said, we were just talking about this, well, talking about it several months ago, and now it's here already. And so thank you for the invitation to come. And looking forward to getting to know many of you better. I wish I could get to know all of you better, but I'm not sure I can make that commitment. Be glad to interact with you, and just wanted to share a little bit about who I am, who we are. We are planning to talk about culture this weekend at your invitation. Thank you for that invitation. I didn't give it any particular title, but every message has its own title. This is my family, and they are here, and my wife Heather. She is from the Shippensburg area. That's her home area. And we have five children. Caitlin is 8. Hudson is 6. Megan just turned 5. Brittany turned 3 just recently. And Kenzie is turning 1 on Sunday. So I tell people that we are just surviving. It's an enjoyable time. And something that Heather and I try to remind each other of, at least occasionally, is these are the best years of our lives. We're going to keep saying that all the way till we're 100 and something years old. We're delighted that God has been with us in the way that he has. We do we are members at Shippensburg Christian Fellowship. That was my wife's home church. And after we got married, we moved away from she moved from the area. For 3 years, we were not in that area. And I was from a more progressive or liberal background. I never would have envisioned joining Shippensburg, but we did in fact do that. And I'll plan to share a little more of my story tomorrow night. I do work in construction for a River Brethren man. How many of you are familiar with River Brethren people? Okay. Are there any? I guess there aren't any around here, but you're familiar with them. Great people. Excellent people. Matt Myers is my boss. We do junky little projects. We do barn roofs. We do house roofs. The latest project this week is putting posts up over a trench so that the farmer can stack straw in there for a project that he is doing. This evening I'd like to talk about the fact that culture, indeed, is consequential. In a book by Daniel Coyle, he poses the question, why do certain groups add up to be greater than the sum of their parts, while others add up to be less? A few years ago, the designer and engineer Peter Skillman held a competition to find out. Over several months, he assembled a series of four-person groups at Stanford, the University of California, the University of Tokyo, and a few other places. And he challenged each group to build the tallest structure possible with a few basic ingredients. So, got to have the paper bag because that increases interest. One of the things that he gave them for building their project was 20 pieces of spaghetti. So they had these 20 pieces of spaghetti. I can bring these to the Saturday morning coffee time, if you like. And he also gave them a yard of string. So we have a yard of string. And they had a yard of tape. So each group had a yard of tape. And we'll just hang that there. And each group had not a whole bag, but one marshmallow. And the challenge for each of these groups, four-person groups, was to build the tallest structure possible in a certain time frame. I don't know what the time frame was. But there was one rule, just one rule, and that is that the marshmallow had to end up on top of whatever structure they built. Now, the fascinating part of the experiment, as Coyle says, was not so much about the task as it was the participants, the people who were engaged in this project. Oh, by the way, if it's okay with you parents, after the service, the children are welcome to each have a marshmallow. If you prefer them not to eat in the sanctuary, I'm fine with that. They can eat outside. But you have to ask your parents. And if one of you children wants to be the dispenser of the marshmallows, feel free to just don't take them all yourself. So they had groups of business school students. We're talking college students. You know, groups of four. They had groups of four that were kindergartners. I know these students are a little older than kindergartners here in this picture. The business school students got right to work. They began talking and thinking strategically. They examined the materials. They tossed ideas back and forth. They asked thoughtful, savvy questions, and they generated several options talking about the most promising ideas. It was professional, it was rational, it was intelligent. The process resulted in a decision to pursue one particular strategy, and then they divided up the tasks and they started building. The kindergartners took a different approach. They did not strategize. They did not analyze or share experiences. They did not ask questions, propose options, or hone ideas. In fact, they barely talked at all. They stood very close to one another. Incidentally, do you have a kindergarten here at the school? Okay, some of you know what I'm talking about. They stood very close to one another. Their interactions were not smooth or organized. They abruptly grabbed materials from one another and started building, following no plan or strategy. And when they spoke in short bursts. Here, no here. Their entire technique might be described as trying a bunch of stuff together. Now, if you had to bet which of the teams would win, it would not be a difficult choice. You would bet on the business school students because they possessed the intelligence, the skills, and experience to do a superior job. And this is the way we normally think about group performance. We presume that skilled individuals will combine to produce skilled performance in the same way we presume that 2 + 2 will combine to produce 4. But your bet would be wrong. In dozens of trials, kindergartners built structures that averaged 26 inches tall, while the business school students built structures that averaged less than 10 inches. Even against teams of lawyers who built towers that averaged 15 inches, as well as teams of CEOs who averaged 22, they defeated both of those groups as well. And as Coyle says, this is hard for us to absorb because it feels like an illusion. He says, we see smart, experienced business school students and we find it difficult to imagine that they would combine to produce a poor performance. And we see unsophisticated, inexperienced kindergartners and we find it difficult to imagine that they would combine to produce a successful performance. But he says, this illusion, like every illusion, happens because our instincts have led us to focus on the wrong details. We focus on what we can see, individual skills. But individual skills are not what matters. What matters is the interaction. The interaction. The business school students appear to be collaborating, but in fact they are engaged in a process that psychologists call status management. They are figuring out where they fit into the larger picture. Who is in charge? Is it okay to criticize somebody's idea? What are the rules here? Their interactions appear smooth, but their underlying behavior is riddled with inefficiency, hesitation, and subtle competition. Instead of focusing on the task, they are navigating their uncertainty about one another. They spend so much time managing status that they fail to grasp the essence of the problem, that the marshmallow is relatively heavy and the spaghetti is hard to secure. As a result, their first efforts often collapse and they run out of time. But the actions of the kindergartners appear disorganized on the surface, but when you view them as a single entity, their behavior is efficient and effective. They are not competing for status. They stand shoulder to shoulder and work energetically together. They move quickly, spotting problems and offering help. They experiment and notice outcomes, which guides them toward effective solutions. The kindergartners succeed not because they are smarter, but because they work together in a smarter way. They are tapping into a simple and powerful method in which a group of ordinary people can create a performance far beyond the sum of their parts. What is it about the kindergartners that makes such an incredible difference in that particular experiment? And this is what Coyle wrote in his book, The Culture Code. He states, group culture is one of the most powerful forces on the planet. You see, what allowed those kindergartners to succeed as they did was the fact that they could tap into this thing of group culture. Maybe our brothers' meetings should be a bit more like the kindergartners and a little less like the business school students. I'm not trying to shake anybody's paradigm up here too much. But maybe a little more childlikeness and a little less childishness. I don't know. The interesting and maybe troubling thing about culture is that it operates largely unseen and thus unnoticed by most people. And so the main thrust of the message this evening is simply this: if culture is virtually invisible, yet very influential, it demands investigation. If culture is virtually invisible and yet very influential, then it does demand our attention. So what is so influential about this entity? There are a number of questions that come to mind when it comes to this matter of culture. What is culture? And I appreciate Brother Jonathan opening as he did, setting the table, so to speak, and whetting our appetite. Is culture a powerful force? I'm sort of making that assumption here in my main thrust. If it is, what gives it the power that it has? What is the purpose of culture? Is it possible, if I try hard enough, to live culture-free? Can a church or a family have too much culture? Why does mankind seem compelled to involve himself in culture? When I talk about the idea that culture is consequential, I do mean it in two ways. One, in the sense, of course, that it matters, it's significant, there's huge value here, but also consequential in the sense that it causes things to happen. It effects powerful changes. There are tremendous consequences from culture. Culture is consequential. For some foundational thoughts, I'd like us to go to our foundational book and the foundational book of the book in Genesis chapter 1. The text is coming from Genesis 1, verse 26, reading from the New King James Version. This is likely a fairly familiar passage to us. Genesis 1, verse 26. Again, looking at it through the lens of culture. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them. God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food." And it was so. What we're seeing here in this text is the concluding work of God. Actually, we know that that whole chapter is about God's amazing creation, taking nothing and making something from the very power of his word, the power of his spoken word. The topic of culture first came on my radar in a major way probably 13 or 14 years ago when I had the opportunity to hear Andy Crouch speak in person. He wrote a book called Culture Making. How many of you are familiar with this book? Oh, good. I don't see a single hand. I love to recommend books that nobody has read yet. This is the latest version. It came out in the last year or so. He updated it. It's expanded version, expanded edition. But this book is very formative, very helpful. If you're going to read one book on culture, I would encourage you to get Andy Crouch's book. I am a huge borrower. I am a student. I'm a learner, and so what I'm sharing with you this weekend is a tip of the iceberg, and it's largely things that I have borrowed from all sorts of people. And I will try to give due recognition to those that I quote from. It's very important to do that. So I'm not pulling these thoughts out of my own head, but they are things that I've been cogitating and thinking about for over a decade now. And of course, then the discussion about culture got even more intense and interesting when John D. Martin decided to write a booklet, To Be or Not to Be Plain. How many of you have read this booklet? Four hands. Great. I get to recommend five, six. I recommend another. Any of you sisters read this book? One, two, three. Okay. We're not at an auction here, but thank you for your hands. This, if you feel like, you know, Andy Crouch's book is a little big, I don't have time to read a whole book, this booklet definitely is the one to read. So I have six copies here. It'll be first come, first serve. And I'm sure that there's a bookstore around somewhere that carries them. But John has done us a wonderful favor in putting together his thoughts on culture, To Be or Not to Be Plain. So in this message, I'd like us to consider two points related to our topic. First of all, to give a fairly, hopefully a thorough explanation of culture, followed secondly by a relatively broad examination of culture. So our initial objective here is explaining culture. It's a fairly audacious undertaking, as Brother Jonathan referenced, and it involves asking a number of questions. I'll share four questions, the first of it, which is, what is culture? What is culture? Literary critic Terry Eagleton, this comes from Crouch's book, observes that culture has been called the second most complicated word in the English language. The second most. So what's the first? Okay, we'll talk about that. How many of you are familiar with Harold Dean Miller? Okay, great. Most of you are. I think it was him that said a number of years ago that culture is what we do. Did anybody hear him say that? You could probably imagine him saying that. And that's pretty good. It does sound pretty broad, sort of like it's the world and everything in it. But that's a great start. Ken Myers, who wrote All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes, and is worth purchasing just for the foreword that he writes, he says that culture is the human effort to give structure to life. The human effort to give structure to life. I think that's a good definition. So what is the most difficult word to define in English language if culture is the second most? Well, Eagleton would say it's nature. Nature. And so I think they are complementary, culture and nature. Just to remind us of what some definitions of nature are, they would include the external world in its entirety. So big definition there. It could also mean the inherent character or basic constitution of a person or thing. He says we use the term about a person. Well, that's just his nature. It's the way things tend to go when left to themselves. So, nature. Whereas definitions of culture would include the art or practice of cultivating, the act of developing by education, discipline, social experience, the training, refining of the moral and intellectual faculties, the total pattern of human behavior and its products embodied in thought, speech, action, and artifacts. Wow, this is huge. This is important. As a definition of culture, the set of shared, Brother Jonathan touched on this, mentioned this, shared attitudes, values, goals, and practices that characterize a company or corporation, or I would include church, group, or family. It's the things that we share together. A basic understanding, I think, of culture, nature, would be that nature is apples, and apple pie is culture. And I like both of those things. We can think of it as nature is what God made, and culture is what man made from what God made. I do like Crouch's adaptation of Myers' definition. Andy Crouch says, culture is what we make of the world. And that's a definition I've fallen back on a number of times. Culture is what we make of the world. And he would say, Crouch would say, that this idea of making something of the world is true in three ways. Culture is what we make of the world. First of all, it's true as far as creation. He says It is, culture is, first of all, the name for our relentless, restless human effort to take the world as it's given to us and make something else. So whether it's because we have to in school or at work, or because we want to, because of a hobby or something that captures our attention or our inspiration, it seems like we are forever taking the ingredients that are available and turning them into something else and making something out of them or adding them together. Creation. So that's a first aspect of making something of the world. A second aspect of making something of the world as a definition of culture is clarification or interpretation. Crouch says that culture also is what we make of the world in a deeper sense of that phrase. When we find ourselves perplexed by a scene in a movie, and I'm not recommending that we watch movies, but when we find ourselves perplexed by something like that or the lyrics of a song, we say to our friends, "What do you make of that?" And he says, we aren't usually asking our friends to write a new scene or sing new lyrics. We aren't asking for more creation. We mean, what sense do you make of it? We're asking for interpretation or clarification. When somebody in a conservative church does something that's completely out of the norm of what we'd expect for a conservative Anabaptist person to do, we have to ask ourselves, what do I make of that? We're not asking them to do something even newer and stranger. We're trying to figure out why they did what they did. So there's that element of creation, that element of clarification, and then a third element of what we make of the world is accumulation. Crouch says, culture is not just what human beings make of the world. It's not just the way human beings make sense of the world. It is, in fact, part of the world that every new human being has to make something of. Culture is cumulative. Our cultural products become part of the world that a future generation must make something of in both senses. So when you decide to build the church building that you did, you handed to the next generation a cultural good with which they must decide what they're going to do with it. You know, what will they accomplish with it? Will they take out the pews and put in interlocking chairs? Will they turn it into more of a fellowship hall type thing? Brother Jonathan is right. Buildings have a culture. The fact that you're sitting in pews that are affixed at a certain angle facing forward indicates something of what you think about of the culture of the church. I don't know if there's any discussion on it, but maybe there's discussion even when you're building the church on whether to have a platform or to keep the podium on the floor. All sorts of questions related to how we view the world and what we make of the world. So with these definitions, culture is the context in which we find ourselves. We don't get to choose our context necessarily, at least not the one that we're born into. But we are certainly quite influenced by that context or that culture. Of course, as we get older, we have that freedom to choose a different culture or a context that is different. But we really can't get away from the fact of how we were shaped from birth by the culture in which we found ourselves. So culture certainly is consequential. What is culture? Culture is what we make of the world, as well as a host of other definitions that go with that. I do like to think of the fact that culture is what we make of the world with others. With others. That's the huge thing. I'm going back to that illustration now with the spaghetti and the marshmallow and the string and the tape. The power of group culture. And really, I'm not sure that culture can exist without a group. What is culture? Secondly, why is there culture? Perhaps coming to some sense of what culture is will help us to get a handle on and understand why culture and cultures exist. Because for some reason, people have this chronic ongoing interest in grouping themselves together around shared ideas, commonalities, relationships, ancestors, ideals, interests. Considering our text here in Genesis 1, I believe that almost every person has this innate desire to take something that they've been given and make it better, to make something out of it, something new, something different, something meaningful. And I think it's related to that mandate there in Genesis 1:28, God's mandate for us, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion. The drive to cultivate, to create, reveals something of God's image in us. It's just there for most people. I'm not going to say 100%, but I think most everybody, 99.9% of people, I think have this desire. Further on in Genesis 2:15, we're told that the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And, of course, as Crouch observes, a garden, of course, is not just nature. It is nature plus culture. So I believe we've been hardwired to exercise to dominion, to cultivate or to keep what exists. And then not just to keep it, but to create, to make something that did not exist before. If you're living a fulfilling life, it's likely you're doing one of these two things. You're either cultivating what has been given to you, or you're creating something new. I'm in construction. I'm in construction with a group, so we have a group culture. But I'm so amazed. When I pick up a 2x4, we got a bunch of junky ones the other day. Just terrible. But we can still try to make something from them. They can be used for roof lath. I'm amazed when I think, you know, I can take this 16-foot 2x4, and I can do whatever I want with it. I can chop that thing into 4-foot sections. I can cut it into a 16-inch section, and I can stick it somewhere where I think it's most useful. And that came from a tree that never existed before and will never exist like that again. I mean, that 2x4 is unique. That's incredible. I get to decide what to do with that thing. Now, I'm not trying to sound godlike, but I find it amazing. I feel responsible. I need to be a good steward of this 2x4, even though it's kind of junky. Make the best of it that I can. And I think that can be true for wherever you find yourself in life. Building storage sheds, if you're an electrician, I think that's pretty amazing. I dabble in it enough to try not to get shocked. But you guys that work at the panel box, you work with the wires coming in from the pole, I mean, that is invisible stuff that is, you know, it's got some bite to it. I've cut through some live wires. I've seen fire. I've dropped the snips because I couldn't help it. But you're harnessing something and making it useful. As an electrician, it's almost magical. Maybe you're an excavator, a farmer, teaching school, teaching your children concepts that they never had before, letters and words that they never understood. You mothers training up your children who never existed before. Wow. You who are creating devotionals and sermons, Sunday school lessons. It's amazing. Why does culture exist? I believe it's hardwired in us to both cultivate, in other words, keep what has been given, I hope, and create something new. And then a third question, what are the building blocks of culture? I think there are probably 3 blocks, but there could be more. I'm open to correction on this. People, places, and things. Sounds like Pictionary, right? People. I like to say that where 2 or 3 people are gathered together, there will be culture. Can't help it. It's going to happen. I'm speaking, of course, in a general sense. And even if you aren't married, if you live at home or you have a housemate, I'm pretty confident that there's some sort of culture there. You have a way of life. You have a way of doing things that just works. It's certainly true in marriage, whether you have children or not. You each influence the other, and a culture develops just in the context of 2. And so there's a matter of doing things together over time, which helps to develop different types of culture. appreciate what Crouch says. He says that one of the most mysterious and beautiful things about culture is that it has to be shared. One person doing something by themselves isn't necessarily a culture maker. He might just be an odd person, or she might be an odd person. In fact, I was single for many years, so I understand bachelorhood. And I had a fellow bachelor friend of mine tell me that, you know, the men that never marry always have some little oddity about them. He's from Alabama. And what's fascinating is that he's in his late 30s, early 40s now, and he's still not married. I'm not sure what his oddity is, but, well, I will say this. He deals in old manuscripts, and he travels the world, so maybe that's his oddity. But a good friend of mine, he's part of the conservative holiness movement. So culture is something that has to be shared. He says, I can walk out alone into the wilderness, and from time to time I should, but I am never alone in culture. I am always accompanied by those who created it before me and share it with me. I can never really escape my responsibility to those who come after me, whose horizon is the possibility I will move in some way for better or worse. So there's a sense in which we have all been influenced by the people who preceded us. The people who chose the design of this building and the school, and to actually have it on these grounds. And I meant to say something earlier, and I'll say it now, but the last time we were with you was for Grace's funeral. And that was a very difficult thing. And I'm sure it's still something you're wrestling through. And I appreciate your coming together and seeking to work through that. It doesn't just go away, but there's waves and there's cycles. And I'm sure it's still very real and raw. And that's the way it usually is. And I want to validate that. But I feel it's my wife's Heather's cousin, Grace was. Even with that, I feel a sense of responsibility. You know, Grace marked my life, not because I knew her so well, but because I was here with you in the midst of that grief. And so there is a sense in which we are responsible to the people who have preceded us, and we are responsible for the people, God willing, who will succeed us, that we will be faithful. Culture is something that we share together. And I shared Meyer's definition earlier. I like what he says. Culture is the human effort to give structure to life. We're trying to figure out how life should be structured. What is the best way to live and operate as a family, as a school, as a church, as a business, as a church among churches? It is human structuring of God's nature, culture. But culture is also places. I'm quite confident that the culture of Stewart's Draft today is very different than it was 100 years ago. And yet, as long as there have been people here in this area, there has been culture. I'm sure that the culture of the buildings and grounds here at Pilgrim Christian Fellowship are different now than when they were first built. Even buildings and places have a way of changing. But as long as there are people in a place, there will be culture in a place. So people, places, and things, cultures tend to be made up of and shaped by cultural goods. Now, not all goods shape culture. Some shape quite a bit of culture. If you have a smartphone, that has radically shaped modern culture, not just in the West, but all over the world. If you think about this cultural good, hymns of the church, this has shaped the conservative Anabaptist world. It sort of delineates for us the songs that we tend to sing. And while there are lots in there are lots of other songs we could sing, but we're going to tend to gravitate toward those because they're accessible. They were put together in a book for us. And it's easier to reach out and pick that up and sing from that hymnal. And so artifacts like that have a way of becoming part of our culture, as they do in every culture. If you said Hymns of the Church in most any church across America, they have no idea what you're talking about. But if you make mention of it in majority of Anabaptist churches, they probably have a clue. So these things are the building blocks upon which people build, and they're also the building blocks with which people build. It seems like the basic elements of culture are togetherness, time, and effort. Togetherness, time, and effort. And there might be something more that you would add to that. I'm open to your input on it. But it seems that culture is something that happens while we're doing life with others over the course of time. I don't think anybody could have projected what beachy Amish Mennonite culture would look like when your churches first came out of the churches they were part of. But here we are. And overall, I think it's a good place to be. I want to affirm you in your Amish Mennoniteness. And I trust that by the end of our weekend together, you'll be even more glad to be Amish Mennonite than you were when we started. We like to do things repeatedly with others. The philosopher Edward Casey wrote, "The very word culture meant place tilled in Middle English. And the same word goes back to the Latin calere, to inhabit, care for, till, worship, and cultus, a cult, especially a religious one." So to be cultural, to have a culture, is to inhabit a place sufficiently intensely to cultivate it, to be responsible for it, to respond to it, to attend to it caringly. We're talking about something that happens over the course of years together. Another thing, because we're talking about people, places, now things, a thing that is very powerful, Brother John, thank you for touching on this, language creates culture. This is something that Will Gadara pointed out in his book, Unreasonable Hospitality. He ran a very successful restaurant in New York City for Danny Myers, who had several successful restaurants that he oversaw. And Gadara says that his boss, Danny Meyer, always understood how language can build culture by making essential concepts easy to understand and to teach. And so he was constantly coining these phrases, these words, to point out their common experiences, potential pitfalls, and to seek favorable outcomes. And what Gadara says, these were repeated over and over to the point that it became part of the restaurant culture. He used things like athletic hospitality, which meant always looking for a win, whether you were playing offense, making an already great experience even better, or defense, apologizing for and fixing an error. Another one that he said was be the swan. Reminded us that all the guests should see was a gracefully curved neck and meticulous light white feathers sailing across the pond surface, not the webbed feet churning furiously below, driving the glide. So the things that we talk about, the ways that we talk about them, have a way of shaping our culture. And perhaps you've heard this, but I think even using a phrase such as non-conformity, and non-accumulation as elements that make up who we are can be very pithy and powerful in shaping our identity. Now, I realize that those are all negatives, but that's not all bad. You can rename it if you like. I mean, that's great. Now, the ideal conformity, the ideal resistance, and the ideal accumulation, I think definitely have merit. But it expresses in shorthand those things that traditionally have made us who we are. And so as we talk about those things as a group and incorporate them, it has a very formative effect on us. Can we live without culture? That's a fourth question to ask. Theoretically, it might be possible for somebody to live culture-free, but God from the very beginning said it is not good for man to be alone. And so I think it indicates that he's designed all of us to live in some sort of community or togetherness, which in turn is going to create some sort of culture. And like we've said, we have this unquenchable desire, interest to group ourselves around, you know, is it Dodge or is it Chevy? Is it John Deere or is it Massey Ferguson or whatever's out there? Frankly, I'm an Oliver fan, so I'm definitely irrelevant. But we like to do that. It seems like we cannot really live without some sort of culture for any length of time. Like me, you've probably seen various people who get sick of their church culture. They decide to go off and start something that's more focused on Jesus, doesn't have all the, quote, cultural baggage. And so in a sense, they're trying to develop something, a church, a group, that's more culture-free. I have watched this many times. I've never seen it succeed. It always turns out to be an exercise in futility. Somehow or another, a culture always springs up. And usually, pretty well 99.9% of the time, it's not nearly as enduring as the one that was left. Sad, but it is so often true. So the best thing they can do is to create a culture-free culture. They'll say that they're culture-free, but they end up having a culture. And so if culture is virtually invisible, and yet it is so influential, it demands investigation. So we've tried to explain culture a little bit there. Secondly now, we're examining culture. Or maybe we should say examining cultures. There's a sense in which all of us go through our lives inhabiting different cultures. Even in a single day. We're going to look at three elements: spheres of culture, scales of culture, and then specific types of culture. When you think about spheres of culture, Andy Crouch says that thinking just in terms of buildings, consider the unique cultural features and the particular forms of world-making embodied in a mall, a sewage treatment plant, a bank, a high school cafeteria, an auto dealership, and he goes on and lists a bunch of other ones, and last but not least, a church. He says, in each of these places, people are making something of the world. We're talking about spheres of culture. But the culture of each building and the culture of the more abstract sphere that they represent, whether it's retail or water or sewage or banking or worship or whatever, has its own history of making and remaking of possibility and impossibility. Many things are entirely possible in a cafeteria, say a food fight, are all but impossible in a dentist office, and vice versa. These various spheres do overlap and influence each other. That is to say, they affect one another's horizons of possibility and impossibility. These spheres of culture can profoundly shape the horizons of possibility and impossibility far beyond their own borders, as when a cell phone sold in the mall is carried into the library, the dentist office, and the church, creating the possibility of instant communication and instant interruption in all of those places. So we understand that. The culture of your school is, I am sure, different from the culture of your Sunday morning worship service, which is different from the culture of your family life at home. In fact, I was just thinking today about, have I ever seen a bank that was in a mobile home? And you know, I think it did once. It was a very odd sight. Seems like something you might see in Appalachia. But usually banks are built with brick, right? It's giving the sense that this is an enduring building that is safe and you can trust us. Something that a bank in a mobile home cannot convey. There's some limitations there. So there are various spheres of culture. Additionally, there are scales of culture. Again, from Crouch, he says a basic unit of culture is the family, where we first begin making something of the world. Food and language, two of culture's most far-reaching forms, begin in the home, which may encompass a, quote, public as small as two people. It can take us decades to appreciate all the ways in which the culture of our family set our horizons of the possible and the impossible. The larger the scale of culture, the less anyone can plausibly claim to be a culture maker. And he says, we will make something of the world in a particular ethnic tradition, in particular spheres, at particular scales. He says there's no such thing as the culture. And any attempt to talk about the culture, especially in terms of transforming the culture, is misled and misleading. What he's saying is we get to choose the scales that we're part of to a degree, and the spheres in which we move, of course. And so when you think about a cultural scale, the influence that you have in your family is probably much greater than the influence that you have here in this church, which is probably much greater than the scale of influence that you have in the entire Beachy-dom, or whatever you call the collective Amish Mennonite world. Which in turn is greater than any influence you would have in the broader Christian world and then the world at large. So you see those scales of culture. As the scale gets bigger, it's less and less likely that we're going to have any measurable impact on transforming the culture. But the closer we get to the smaller scale, oh, yeah, I can choose, mostly, when my children go to bed and say, it is bedtime now. I have some influence there. Influence that I don't have at the bigger scale. What's interesting to me is when I think about a family member coming into my family through birth or adoption or something of that nature, there's a way in which it does change our culture irreversibly. Or at least majorly, as long as they're with us. But the same thing is true of when a person joins a church. They become a member. When I sought membership at Shippensburg Christian Fellowship, I said in my testimony that, you know, I will probably change the church in ways that nobody could foresee, and I will be changed by the church in ways that I could not have foreseen. That's just how it works when there's give and take and interaction. And so it's interesting to think about how those dynamics shift and move as we think about different spheres and then different scales. No church, I believe, can gain or lose people without it somehow, in a little way, changing the culture that they had, either for better or for worse. And then I'd like us to think about specific types of culture. We looked at spheres, scales, and now specific types. This has to do more with big, broad cultures that impact almost all of society, that impact us. And I'm particularly considering the types of culture within the North American context. There have traditionally been three main types of culture in North America. There's been the sacred culture, there's been folk culture, and there's been high or classical culture. I'm indebted for a lot of these thoughts from a book by T. David Gordon called Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. Have any of you read this book or you're familiar with it? Okay, Brother Jonathan is. Excellent book, very interesting. Subtitle is How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. Basic premise of the book is that Johnny and Jill, whoever, are so surrounded by this latest newcomer, so fourth style of culture is pop, so surrounded by pop style music everywhere, at the gas station, in the store, every public place virtually, that when Johnny comes to church and hears these hymns, they don't sound like music to him. He doesn't have a category for this style of music. It's not anything like he's been growing up on, listening to. What I like about what Gordon says is that, and he's laying these categories out mainly in terms of music. We could look at them in other areas of life too. When he talks about sacred music, he talks about sacred music as being its own entity that remained a certain way for hundreds of years. There was some real stability there. And how it's only been in the last 5-6 decades that there was a real push to change sacred music to become more like the dominant cultural styles. In the folk style, the folk music, that has more to do with the community that one finds themselves in, and it was bound to community norms. It involved things that people were engaging in on a daily basis, or at least were familiar with. I think of songs like Home, Home on the Range, Oh Susanna, things like that. There's nothing inherently wrong with those songs. They're just good down-home songs that talk about folk life. And my speculation is, I'm not an expert on it, but I think early country music had a lot of that folk style to it, which made it feel very benign and safe, I guess, to people that were listening to it or engaging it, a folksy type music. And then with your high and classical music, of course, we would think of symphonies, orchestras, operas. It could be instrumental, could be vocal, could be both. But that had to do with improved sensibilities. In other words, it takes some doing to appreciate that style. So how did this change so radically in the last 6, 7, 8 decades? What happened is you have mass production, the Industrial Revolution, which is aimed toward the population at large, popular, so that the most money possible can be made on the good or service provided. By and large, music today, pop music, is not about helping people understand life more or deal with. It's about making a buck. And what is it that's going to bring the money in? What's going to raise ticket sales? What's going to make the tour successful? It is a style that is easily accessible, doesn't take any work, very entertaining, and any person could walk into it and sort of appreciate it, especially if that person has no grounding in a higher style of music or culture. So he says, pop culture exists as the child of two parents, mass media and commercial forces. And so pop means aimed at the population at large. Ken Myers argues that the war between popular culture and high culture effectively ended in the 1960s. So quite a while ago, high culture lost out, pop culture became the dominant form. And I think you can see that in the musical genres, whether, and I'm not real versed in these things, but as far as you look at country, jazz, southern gospel, bluegrass, almost all of those musical genres have now been flattened by pop. Pop has basically taken over every musical style, if it's going to make a lot of money anyway. And I find that very fascinating, and I also find that very sad. According to Myers, he says, the sensibilities or the feelings promoted by pop or mass culture are imminent, monogenerational. It doesn't look to the generation behind or the generation to come. It's just one generation. Very banal or commonplace, individualistic, accessible. In almost every way possible, he says, the sensibilities of pop culture differ from those of classical and folk. It is imminent in the sense that it celebrates the present moment and situation divorced from the past and the future. It lives viscerally in that moment. It surrounds itself with guitars, for instance, because the guitar has become the musical voice of a particular place and a particular time. Pop culture is self-consciously and intentionally monogenerational. It intends to sound novel and views itself as artistically pioneering. The sensibilities of pop culture are also individualistic rather than communal. Folk culture had to do with the community. Pop culture is just about the individual. And so on and so forth. Pop culture celebrates individual self-expression and experience at the expense of community expression and experience. Since it is the purpose of most forms of popular culture to provide exciting distraction, we should not be surprised that over time, television programs, popular music, and other forms become more extreme and more offensive in their pursuit of titillation or stimulation. Folk culture has the capacity to limit its extremes since it was the expression of the values and aspirations of a community. Popular culture, on the other hand, presupposes the absence of a community, a belief, or conviction. It is, for many, a means of escape from such a community. Furthermore, he says, Not all popular culture is produced for young people, but the spirit of popular culture continues to be the spirit of youth culture, suspicious of authority and of the past, allergic to formality, impatient with the limitations of propriety, and fearful of being perceived as uncool. To be young today, or stubbornly to think of oneself as young, is to see life as all possibility and no necessity. And I think these thoughts from Myers explain a lot about why creating and sustaining brotherhood feels like, and I think it has gotten a lot harder in this cultural climate. Because whether we ever listen to a pop song or not, brothers and sisters, we are in that cultural press that is called pop culture. And I have a feeling that it has ways of influencing our mindset even more than we realize, as much as we don't want it to. He says, living in the matrix of popular culture, we are encouraged to see ourselves as sovereign consumers who construct the meaning of our lives from our free choices. By contrast, on a pre-modern and Christian view, the wisdom and meaning embedded in a cultural legacy, faithfully transmitted from one generation to the next, was an aid whereby we could be trained to discipline our desires and so be free from captivity to mere appetites. Cultures historically set boundaries. Popular culture, as the preeminent form of modern culture, encourages liberation. He says, there is something new about popular culture. Modern popular culture is not just the latest in a series of diversions. It is rather a culture of diversion. So I have a list of, competing sides, you might say, of a contrast between pop culture and traditional or high classical culture. Gordon would say that traditionally in the past, the church tended to align itself more with the traditional, the high classical culture, or the folk culture. And when I'm saying high culture, don't just hear me saying hoity-toity, but something that has some enduring value. And so I'm going to go down through these fairly quickly. Don't feel like you need to write them down. I have a handout that probably the last night, the third or fourth session, we'll make sure you get a copy of this chart. But I find it so helpful to consider the differences. So this is from Ken Myers' book, but quoted in Gordon. Pop culture focuses on the new, whereas your traditional or classical culture focuses on the timeless. Pop culture discourages reflection. Traditional culture encourages reflection. Pop culture pursued casually to, quote, kill time. High culture, classical culture pursued with deliberation. Pop culture gives us what we want, tells us what we already know, whereas higher classical culture offers us what we could not have imagined. Popular culture relies on instant accessibility. It encourages impatience, whereas traditional or high culture requires training and encourages patience. Pop culture emphasizes information and trivia. Higher classical culture emphasizes knowledge and wisdom. Pop culture celebrates fame. Classical culture celebrates ability. Why are famous people today famous? It's because they're famous. Pop culture appeals to sentimentality. Traditional and classical culture appeals to appropriate, proportioned emotions. Pop culture tends to be individualistic. High classical culture, traditional culture tends to be communal. Pop culture leaves us where it found us. And I like to say these churches have the signs, come as you are. And I add sort of myself under my breath, yes, and leave as you came, unchanged. Traditional and high classical culture transforms our sensibilities. Pop culture is incapable of deep or sustained attention. Traditional or classical culture is capable of repeated, careful attention. Popular culture reflects the desires of the self, whereas traditional culture encourages understanding of others. And pop culture tends toward relativism, whereas traditional and high culture tends toward submission to standards. And so in light of this listing here, this chart, I'd like you to spend the next 22 hours or so thinking to yourself and identifying potential pop cultural influences in your life and in your mindset. Now, looking at you, I don't think any of you have an ounce of pop culture influence in your life, but there might be. So think about it. Is there any way in which pop culture sensibilities or insensibilities have seeped into my thinking and are causing me to think in ways that are unhelpful to the brotherhood or even to my family or to a legacy that I want to leave. The podcast choices, the music that we're listening to, the things that we're daydreaming about, am I pressing more toward a classical traditional culture, or am I sort of floating along toward a more pop culture idea in my existence? You know, the broader church world has scads of books about worldview, about apologetics, about knowing what we believe and how to engage the culture, and yet very little enduring kingdom fruit to show for it. I'm not beating them up here. I'm just trying to make an observation. But lots of efforts, and yet it feels like moving the needle very little. What is the struggle there? What is lacking in that? Lord willing, we'll examine that question as the weekend unfolds. In closing, even though culture operates largely under the radar in many ways, I hope that it's become a bit more visible to you this evening to think about how it does influence our lives. Because invisible does not mean insignificant. Just ask any electrician who's been shocked. Invisible can be very significant. Culture is very consequential. So if culture is virtually invisible, yet very influential, I believe it does demand investigation.